You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we support Kid Rock's platform of getting in the pit and trying to love someone. And I would like to put the emphasis on the trying, and that also does not mean attempted rape. It means get in the pit and try to find someone who will love you back. I mean, I feel like if Kid Rock runs for office, I'm literally going to have to continually translate everything he says in this way. If you enjoy your trip in the midside here today, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism. In fact, in light of that fact, I would like to give a shout out to Midsider Alfred, who referred Midsider Megan, who sent me a nice message the other day saying how much she and her husband enjoy the show.
P.S. And that, please stop sending me dick pics.
I'm the one on Snapchat, so I don't know why you're sending him dick pics, but I don't think you guys know how dick pic works. If you send it to him via Facebook Messenger or other ways, those stay in perpetuity. We can use those against you when you run for office one day. As I was saying about Mid-Center Megan before I was totally derailed, she sent a very nice note about how her and her husband enjoy the show. And that kind of spiritual fuel is also a great support for the show. She mentioned in the message, you know, she can't financially support the show through patreon.com/themidside. It's per episode, per content. And she messaged she can't do that. And you know what? That's fine. There's a reason we release these episodes for free. That's why we say, you know, if you can't support financially, tell a friend. Hit us up with a 5-star review on iTunes. Or awesome messages are very, very welcome. And that was an awesome message. So thank you, Midsider Alfred. Thank you, Midsider Megan. Joining me this trip, as you've already heard, oh, by the way, I'm your host, Justin Nemozneski. I had a conversation last night with someone where I was like, I always forget to say my name. I almost did it again, but I remembered. So I'm your host, Justin Nemozneski, and joining me this trip from our nation's capital, as you've already heard and sent him a lot of dick pics, Daniel T. Richards.
You realize I was saying that's what her note said. Did you miss the entire joke that I was... Excellent. Regardless, Spiritual Fuel sounds like a contemporary objectivist gospel band.
What?
What?
Say it again. I was trying to talk over you.
I know. I said Spiritual Fuel sounds like a contemporary objectivist gospel band.
It does. It does. I agree. And I missed the joke because she's a little out of my range for who I would send dick pics to.
So she's not a 19-year-old Filipina.
Well, there's that, but that's not what I was saying. She will get the joke.
This is going to get joke. Real weird for her listening right now.
That was an intro. We like to personalize
the show for every single listener. It's what we like to do. And we can do that because we only have a dozen.
Also joining us from the hills of white privilege, as you just heard him butt in, James Elias.
Love to butt in. And I will be butting in throughout the show. Stay tuned for more of that, Midsiders.
I would just like to clarify that you apparently threw a Anchorman Will Ferrell movie reference at me with the whale's vagina. And I did not get that when you said you were in San Diego, so you were from a whale's vagina. I did not get that because I hate Will Ferrell movies.
All right, well, you're lost.
Yeah.
Actually, most of them are pretty fucking stupid. I like him, though. It's the movies he's in that tend to be dumb.
The only one that I've actually genuinely like is Elf. And the one that I think is a bit underrated, though somewhat annoying, is Talladega Nights. So
the funny thing about that is there's a Highlander joke in there, which is ridiculous. So
I like how the French guy says he drives in Formula 1. That's my favorite joke.
I just laughed at that. You're making me look like a hypocrite now. Shut up. Awesome, James. So I want to talk real briefly before we get started here. This week coming up is a big week at San Diego Comic-Con, and with that, there are a lot of, like, exclusive, like, collectibles that are released, and if you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know Daniel and I collect Funko Pops. And with the Funko Pop community, especially when there's exclusives, a lot of people buy them up and then resell them at higher prices, and these people, they're called flippers in the parlance of the collectible community. I think, Daniel, that term extends beyond Funko Pops, right? That's just like collectibles in general.
Yeah, that's just a general term.
Yeah, that's just a general term.
For anyone who doesn't know, you should explain what a Funko Pop is.
So a Funko Pop, for those of you who don't have Google, is a vinyl figure that is like 6 inches tall, and they have a lot of licenses. So basically, you know, you can put it next to your penis to see how big it is. But
Anything that's six inches just is a reference point, really.
Yeah,
Here's a hot dog. Here's a 357 revolver next to my dick. You know, whatever.
Women out there, if you're very poor at estimating length and guys tell you they're big, just have a Funko Pop on you at all times that you can just, like, take out. But so they are six-inch vinyl figures made out of Washington State that they have a bunch of different licenses for, so it's really cool. You can have figures across properties that look similar. And it's cool in that way to have like a large collection of these things that all look similar, even though they're different properties. And they're going to be releasing a bunch of Comic-Con exclusives this week. And the flippers will be out in full force, selling them for higher prices than they're sold on the market by Funko themselves. And I saw a post recently of a Target exclusive. Some girl bought a Target exclusive and then was trying to sell it for like, or I don't know if it was a Target exclusive, but it was an exclusive. And she was trying to sell it for like $80.
Damn.
And she put in her post, "If you don't like my price, please stop responding and stop price shaming me." What I want to know is, what point does the shaming thing go too far? Can we just introduce the concept of life shaming? The idea that, like, you're price shamed? Like, if you feel shame for something, maybe it's wrong, and maybe you know it's wrong. Like, it's the same thing with the fat shaming I say, right? Like, maybe you feel ashamed of being fat because you know there's something wrong with it. But now it's just like, anytime anyone critiques you for anything, it's like the new hater. You can just be like, oh, well, you know, stop foot shaming me, or stop shirt shaming me. Like, stop podcast shaming me, guys.
Stop child porn shaming me. Jeez.
Yeah. Like, how far does it go? And isn't the ultimate extreme of it just life shaming? Like, God, why are you life shaming me? This is my life. I can live it how I want.
Charles Manson's going to be out on parole, so apparently people stopped murder shaming him.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that.
I think it's actually fine what she's saying in principle, because it's like she's just trying to be entrepreneurial and give people a value they wouldn't have. They're willing to pay the egregious price for it. So it's like, yeah, you shouldn't shame her for her entrepreneurial action. But I don't like the phrase shaming. It seems to be loaded with some sort of bullshit.
I'm going to disagree. I'm going to shit on your point, James. I know it's supposed to be yes and, but I'm going to say no and why.
Okay.
Yes, you have every right to try and sell it for any price you want. But if it's a free market, which includes a free market of ideas, people have every right to respond and be like, nah, your price is fucking retarded. That's just part of the free market.
Sure, you can say it, but you're being rude. Like, you're allowed to charge whatever you think you could get away with. Like, you don't owe me a good price on the good.
I agree, but it also is rude to try and charge people three times what people would pay for it. You're basically saying people are stupid. So it goes both ways.
I don't know. Well, you can't get a hold of this thing other than through her, right? So maybe it is worth $80 to you.
It's one of these things, James, where most people can't get a hold of these things because of the market created around people waiting in line to go get them and then resell them.
Right, so they're kind of getting a value for free, in a sense. Yeah.
Well, they're getting a value for living an unhealthy life. So, for instance, I left work 45 minutes early the other day to pick up a Target exclusive 2-pack with Iron Man, because I collect all the Iron Man ones. I looked online on a site that said that they were in stock in all the local Targets, like the one 15 minutes from work, right down the street from my house. By the time I got from work to the Target, they were all sold out. And then I was like, can you call another Target? And they were all sold out at the other Target too, even though all of those said they were in stock. So there are people who their entire lives are doing this. And the question I have is, what is their quality of life? Additionally, that they are able to get there ahead of everyone else.
Well, it's not even just that. There is that element to it, but it's become a point now where these companies are going to have to figure out how to handle this, because most of these flippers are people who work at Target or who work at Walmart or GameStop, and they just buy all the exclusives and then they sell them online.
Right. I was talking to the Hot Topic manager the other day, and he talks about how people come in and try to get chases. And I was like, yeah, but the worst is Target. And he said, yeah, they have hookups with the flippers where the employees will put them aside for specific flippers, and they get it every time no matter what.
Yeah.
Doesn't that
market failure, time for government regulation.
Aren't meeting demand?
Yeah. I mean, I think this isn't a market failure, but this is something where the incentives are a little bit messed up, and I think ultimately it's going to be on Funko to figure out how to fix this problem so they don't piss off longtime collectors.
Yeah.
But the point is...
Or Joe Biden. Get Joe Biden on this.
It's more than he would have done in 8 years.
Does Joe Biden collect Cheribos?
Anyway, the point I'm making is it's got nothing to do with we can get into this detailed discussion of flippers, which I'm sure is great pod for all the listeners out there. But the point I'm making is obviously these people are pissing a lot of people off. And then when people respond and like, I'm pissed off, they're just like, stop price shaming me. It's like you have no right to say anything if anyone feels any bad emotion anymore. And we just say the shaming thing.
Yeah.
So from now on, I'm just going to be like, when you guys make fun of me, I'm gonna be like, stop joke shaming me. Like, okay, as guys, why don't we complain about like if a girl doesn't like our dick, why aren't we like, stop dick shaming me?
Oh, I'm sure we're there. I'm sure we're there.
I don't know if I've ever gotten that. Like, just don't like your dick. Everything else about you is great. Don't like the dick.
The dick's too small. And you know who probably has
D?
Who probably often
more like a D minus.
That's good.
Oh, hey-o.
And you know who probably hears that a lot?
The
Japanese? Young Japanese men. Yeah, and that's probably why they're not having sex.
Okay.
Let's hear more about that in The News with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Big Trouble in Little Tokyo. Somewhat of a joke there that Justin ripped off before the transition, but nonetheless.
Nearly... That was a brilliant transition. You take that back.
Yeah. Stop transition shaming me. Nearly one-third of Japanese people are entering their 30s without any sexual experience, according to recent research. The country is facing a steep population decline as a growing number of youngsters abstain from sex and avoid romantic relationships. In fact, some men claim they, quote, find women scary, unquote, as a poll found that 31% of people aged 18 to 34 from Japan say they are virgins. One woman, when asked why they think 64% of people in the same age group are not in relationships, said she thought men cannot be bothered to ask the opposite sex on dates because it was easier to watch internet porn. The number of births dropped below 1 million in Japan for the first time last year, according to the Ministry of Health. And Japan's National Institute for Population and Social Security Research predicts that the country's current population of 127 million will decline by 40 million by 2065. The fertility crisis has left politicians scratching their heads as to why youngsters aren't doing it. So, Justin, why aren't Japanese youngsters doing it?
Hold on, I just need to finish booking this flight to Japan. See, here's the thing, right? So, first of all, I want to be clear. I am somewhat in this demographic. I was almost a virgin until I was 30, so maybe I have some first-hand experience. But I also don't think we can 100% port American culture over to Japanese culture because we're not the same.
What?
So I don't want to make that comparison. But at the same time, that's the disturbing thing for me, is it almost seems like we're heading down this
sexless
path.
Route.
Yeah. I mean, we saw this with the sexodus and everything, right? And we can get into that in a second, because there are statistics that show that sort of American society might be heading there. But to maybe speculate a little bit about Japan first, is it like the ease and efficiency of porn? It's sort of like, and I mean, this is sort of, we can apply this principle to why it's happening in American society as well, but Is it that it's easier to just watch porn and jerk off than it is to, like, woo a woman? Like, because the idea of being intimidated by a Japanese woman to me is like, you know, being intimidated by the Cleveland Browns. Like, you're not like, oh, man, that's the one on the schedule. Like, I'm afraid of losing that game. Like, oh, man, we play the Browns. That's going to suck. So, like, the fact that they are, I mean, that says a lot about, like, how emasculated they've been. But it just seems like, so maybe then it's not the emasculation. It's the whole idea of it just being easier to watch porn.
Could be. I mean, I think porn certainly has an effect on people across cultures. I don't think we know what the long-term effect of that is quite yet. And like anything, there is no free lunch in nature. So there is going to be some detrimental side of that. Let's see. One comedian, apparently, I don't know why they interviewed a comedian, but he said, quote, "I don't have self-confidence. I was never popular among the girls. Once I asked a girl out, but she said no, and that traumatized me. There are a lot of men like me who find women scary. We're afraid of being rejected." Could that really
That's what I'm saying. There's like, something more going on here. Like, when you talk about American society and you talk about, I mean, we've said this many times on the show, where the girl went around and raped a bunch of guys, and then she accused the guy of rape. Well, that's the society we're living in right now. Even the Columbia story this week, where, what was it, Daniel? They said that her case was thrown out, but the guy was still punished or something?
Yeah, the Mattress Girl case. We all remember her. She accused a guy of rape. There's basically no evidence to suggest that he did it. The conviction was thrown out, but the school still punished him. And so then he sued the school. The school not only punished him, but also they allowed the girl to carry around the mattress for all 4 years and basically shame him in front of the entire school. And then he sued them, and they settled. So.
Right, and she still has not been punished for false accusation, because we don't have books on the law, laws on the book, that say that you can be punished for this thing that can destroy a man's life. You can't be punished for doing that falsely.
So we
still don't have that in there.
I think we do have laws, or some states certainly have laws. I don't know about federally, but it's very selectively prosecuted. We'll put it that way.
You got to be really careful with stuff like that. I mean, Mattress Girl sounds like, yes, you would apply such a law, but in general, you really got to be careful.
All right, you
like
white
that.
Knight, we get it. Like, women are special creatures,
Justin,
that can be protected.
Like, you do have to be careful. You can, because otherwise, I mean, you could talk about this for any crime. You don't want to have this fear when you're reporting a crime at all, because it's already a huge burden to report any crime.
It is, but in the cases where there is no evidence. And, you know, I don't know. I think we should loosen up a tiny bit
malicious,
with it.
You know, intent, or the fact that, like, there was no evidence and there was no way you could have interpreted it that way. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So back to the sexless
Japan. Back to Japan, yeah.
Right, but that's the point I'm getting at. That's how it's relevant. Like, I understand how you don't want to discourage people from reporting actual crimes. And that's what I'm saying here, that it's gone too far. And that maybe there's something similar in Japanese culture, that they're afraid of women because it's not just like that they're rejecting them, they're emasculating them. Because it's the same thing in our culture, right? And we're talking about, like, you know, price shaming or dick shaming. We were joking around about that. But isn't there a certain amount of, like, rejection shaming? Like, I've heard about this before, where certain women will be like, if a guy approaches them and she thinks she's out of his league, she'll take it as an insult. Like, how dare he even think, like, why would he even think he has a chance with me?
Yeah, I've had that
before. Why would he even think he dare approach me? That's an insult. When really that's just, hey, this person's not attracted to me. Like, thank you for the compliment. I mean, I get hit on by gay guys. Do I go, do they think I'm gay? That's an insult. They must think I'm gay. It's just, no. They find me attractive. Thank you. I'm not interested. I'm straight. I appreciate the compliment. But women, they will, some women, I'm not saying all, but there are women out there who will date shame you or request shame you or however we want to say it. And I'm intentionally using that language to mock them. But that can be, if you don't have a healthy self-esteem and you're second-handed, that can be very damaging to your psychology, to be like, oh, wow, how dare I shouldn't have even asked her out. And it can become traumatizing in that way. So I don't know if that's going on in Japanese culture, but I think that's definitely going on in American culture.
And there's certainly something going on that seems to be at least somewhat cross-cultural, because there are many countries where the birth rates are declining. In fact, America is one of them. This comes from the Washington Post, which they describe as American teens becoming more conservative about sex. I don't know why they use that terminology, but according to the new Center for Disease Control and Prevention report reflecting data from 2011 to 2015, about 42% of girls and about 44% of boys aged 15 to 19 reported that they'd had sex. Both numbers continue a gradual decades-long decline. In 1988, for instance, 51% of girls and 60% of boys in the same age group answered affirmatively. So this is the lowest it's been in quite a while, and it's continuing to fall, which indicates that there has to be something going on cross-culturally that is leading this, don't you think?
Yeah, 100% there has to be, and that's why I initially raised the porn point. We've talked a lot about, and I've heard this on the Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew show as well, is about the illusion of options that comes with the online dating apps and all of these things where, you know, used to, as Adam Carolla says, you walk down the street, you meet someone, you're like, yeah, we're going to make this work. But now you can just swipe all day and you have this illusion of options, because on a very shallow level, it's like, oh, I could fuck all these people, when that doesn't mean you're compatible with them. So I do think with technology, there's a lot of a change of the way people think about interacting with each other. Where one, you seem to think you have all these options, and two, when the options fall through, you just rub one out and you get the immediate high of the orgasm of masturbation, and then you move on. So everything becomes very, the long term is lost. That's something we touch base on a lot. The long term is lost and you're left with the short term. And I think there's a lot of that going on.
In your case, the very short term.
Is that a height joke or a dick size joke or both?
Oh, I don't know, whatever you want it to be. Which is more insulting? It's that one.
I think whatever's happening in Japan here, yeah, there is something, there is, I don't know what's going on here. Part of this for America seems to be good, because the teenage pregnancy and then also the use of contraceptives is going up, so all of that's a really good thing, I think. But I think, yeah, this does seem to be a sort of problem, and I'm not sure what it could be porn, it could be feminism. I'll say this though, in Japan, and this comes from my anime watching, it seems to be something different, completely different for them, because they are really weirdly skittish about sex. Like, they'll, in anime, sex is a kind of really awkward joke, and like there's this one protagonist who's really cool, but then there's these three girls who are into him, and they all are vying for his attentions, and he's just very like scared of all of them. He's just like, oh no, and then he kind of like tries to avoid them and all of this, and it's so weird. I just couldn't, it's part of the Japanese-iness of anime I'll just never understand.
The Japanese cheesiness?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good word for it, because it is very... It's coming from this cultural assumption that the Japanese must have that I just don't understand. It's like, okay, like, it's so crazy. It's so weird. It's so fucking weird.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but they've always been sort of more of a puritanical culture, correct?
Something like that, yeah. It's different than our puritanism, but it's... Yeah, you could describe it that way.
Well, I don't know. Some people are certainly not puritanical. In fact, there's one mom this week who made the news when she was breastfeeding her baby during sex.
Okay, I'm going to guess woke on this one.
She posted a vlog about it and got immediate backlash, but you'd think, according to this article, her viewers would be more open-minded about such things, because Tasha Malali, I have no idea, describes herself as a vegan breastfeeding mama. and she does most of her videos.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
Can I ask a question? Because I didn't realize she was vegan. Can you be vegan and let your own kid breastfeed off of you? Like, that's anti-vegan, isn't it?
That's right. Now the kid isn't vegan now.
Yeah.
Oh my God, because you're using an animal.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so meta.
So I talked to a vegan about this issue, that issue in particular, not the breastfeeding during boinking issue, but about breastfeeding in general. And his answer is that because the mom is sentient and gives consent, it's okay. But animals can't give consent. So it's never okay.
I mean, at least it's logically consistent.
Yeah.
It might be retarded, but it's logically consistent, yeah, so whatever.
Okay. So she does almost all of her videos with her infant attached to her nipple. But alas, people were not all that pleased with it. So she did an interview where she said, she defended herself saying, if the baby is okay, the baby is okay. Which is actually unassailable logic.
Thanks, Aristotle.
She said during the interview, during which she was breastfeeding, that babies aren't sitting there judging you and thinking, quote, my mom and dad are having sex. It's a 2 or 3 month old babies. They're so innocent. All right, Justin, time for you as a straight white male to weigh in on breastfeeding during coitus.
Let me mansplain for a moment here. No, I don't want to explain anything. I just want to ask questions.
Okay.
My first question is, how much does this fucking kid need to breastfeed? If she's, like, during sex in every interview and every vlog? Like, then that's ultimately what it seems like. It seems like she's waiting to breastfeed to do these other things as well. It's like, she's just sitting around all day. It's like, oh, the kid needs to breastfeed now. Hey, honey, time to fuck. Like, isn't there any point where the kid is, like, asleep where you guys can fuck? And then my other question from a child development standpoint is, are we really going to say this doesn't affect the kid? Now, maybe the kid, like, hasn't developed language skills and, like, he can't, like, have complex moral reasoning yet. But isn't it proven that a lot of what your basic personality is developed in the beginning years and the foundation is laid by the way you're treated by your parents?
Well, before we get too deep into that road, there is a significant difference between a 2 or 3 month old baby and even like a 7 or 9 month old baby.
Well, I know. That's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah. So like before 6 months, I think you basically have no memories. So I'm not sure exactly how much gets developed there, but
I don't even know if that's the question. Like, I don't know. The kid's probably going to be fine. The question is why the fuck do you feel the need to do this? That's the real question. It's just because it's such a pain in the ass to have sex while you're breastfeeding. It means this on purpose, which raises a lot of weird questions.
Well, I want to be clear here for a second, James. I think she's probably just laying there is what I think's going on. I don't think she's doing any work.
But regardless,
sure, but that's not the issue. Why does she feel the need to do this?
Yeah, like, okay, I am not a parent, and I have major sympathy in terms of parents for their how much of a time commitment it is and how you get very little sleep in the first, you know, year or so. But
he's got a dog now, so he's like, I don't want to have kids. Fucking, it's a dog.
That's right. But, like, no, I know
like
parents...
Xerxes trying to take over Sparta right now, and I'm going to raise a fucking kid?
But I know parents who have lots of children. Thank you. Thank you. My dog's name is Xerxes. So I know parents who have a lot of kids, and the ones I can be really honest with, they sort of have looped me in on, like, this whole, like, we kind of blow this out of proportion as a culture kind of thing. Like, in fact, your baby does just kind of lay there for a long time. For long periods of time. Like you can pick it up and hold it and play with it, whatever. But it's kind of just content. Just kind of sitting there. During which, you could have sex if you wanted to. And not have it attached to your breast.
The sleeping thing is blown out of proportion? Like parents not sleeping?
I mean, it's not universal, obviously. But it's a little bit blown out of proportion at this point. It's become sort of just a running cultural gag as opposed to something that reflects 100% of reality.
That's what my suspicion was.
Or a running cultural excuse to avoid other things, like sex.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure,
okay.
Absolutely.
Those are both my suspicions.
But again, it's hard. It's just not like, you know, you have people talking about, oh, it's the hardest thing you'll ever do in your life. And the parents that I've talked to who have multiple children are like, it's not that hard. Like, it's hard, but it's not, you know, it's not rocket science. It's not putting fucking submarine at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. Like, you'll be okay. Literally billions of people have done it.
Well, right. That's my principle with things about how difficult they are. Like, it can't be that hard if all these stupid people are having, like, lots of kids. Like,
I just think of Bill Burr when he goes, no job can be the hardest job if you can do it in your pajamas and you could be replaced by a DVD player. Yeah. That's right. So one of the questions I have is, you know, other than sort of like practicality, there's sort of a prudence question as well, which is some women have erogenous zones in their nipples, for instance.
Oh.
And, like, if this woman is having sex.
You said that like you didn't know that. You were like, oh, wow, really?
I'm trying to say it as diplomatically as possible. My point is, if this woman has a child attached to her nipples during sex, there's potentially some incredible weirdness going on here that is sort of, to me, is more important than the practicality question, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, that's what James was getting at as well, is why would you do this?
Yeah, like, I don't want to accuse her of anything specific like this, but it's just like, yeah, there's this and a million other things that could be going on here, and it, why do you have to do this? This is, bah! And what's
right.
worse is that this article clearly is trying to back her up, like, oh, she has a powerful message. Like, really? Like, this is what power is?
Right.
Power is
Winston Churchill
saying that we're going to fight evil in the streets and in the mountains. And like, no, it's not like we will let them suck our titties while we're getting fucked.
While we're on the toilet. While we're gardening. While we're getting Jamba Juice. That's right.
While we're being interviewed. We shall never put a bra on.
This will be much funnier later in the episode, ladies and
gentlemen. I'm going to put forward this to you two, and I'm going to put forward this question and this supposition. What if she's not doing this at all? What if this is just to get attention and she's saying that? We have no real proof. You can't prove it. You can't be like, post a video of you breastfeeding while having sex. Like, now you're asking her to create porn.
Well, I'm sure Pornhub has asked, but yeah. No, I get your point.
So, I don't even really believe she's doing this. I think she's just saying this for attention.
I'm not as cynical as Justin. I believe she is actually doing it. And my point in bringing up the whole erogenous thing is not to accuse her of anything, but it's basically to say that the backlash against this is not like these are a bunch of KKK members trying to burn a cross in her lawn. Like, there's legitimate reasons for the backlash against this. And this article and she should not be surprised by it. She is not some social justice hero. She's an idiot. And potentially
what
a liar.
Is she, though? What race is she?
I have no idea. I don't care. I can't pronounce her name, so she's something foreign.
She looks Malaysian.
Speaking of people who hate
those
people of other
Asians.
Races, Donald Trump. Just kidding. Just kidding. I'm just kidding. Donald Trump is being sued by some Twitter users who he has blocked. Yes, indeed. As this article begins, being blocked by President Trump on Twitter might sound like a blessing, but seven people who can claim that badge of honor don't see it that way. So on Tuesday, they sued the president. The users, who are blocked for calling Trump a hashtag fake leader, among other things, say he is violating the First Amendment rights by preventing them from reading and replying to his tweets. Represented by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Hey, speaking of Columbia, they argue that Trump's Twitter account is the equivalent of a digital town hall, and barring citizens from interacting with him is like banning them from a public park or city council meeting. Sean Spicer and Trump's social media director Dan Scavino are also named in the suit. So, Justin, is Trump, as President of the United States, allowed to block people on the Twitters?
If you can sue people for blocking you on Twitter, I'm owed a lot of money by a lot of people.
That's right.
Just want to be clear about that. So you people better pay up. But the greater question to me here is not if Trump is allowed or not. It seems pretty obvious he's allowed, and this is just a stupid either cash grab or what I think the greater point is. Look, when Obama was president, They had the whole stupid birther thing, right? But did they have constant movements looking to delegitimize his presidency and find a way to get him kicked out of office?
It depends on who you ask, but I get your point.
It just seems like there's this obsession, and we saw this a little bit with W, but it was more just always saying, not my president, not my president, not my president, wearing stupid t-shirts saying, not my president. But now it's like every week they try and find a new way to get Trump kicked out of office or delegitimized. There is an unhealthy obsession here.
It's the resistance, man. It's the resistance. They got lots of time. That's right. God has smiled upon us this day. Anyway, I think the legal issue here is interesting in a sort of stupidly nerdy kind of way. Basically, the idea being that is the president's Twitter account the equivalent of a town hall because he's the president of the United States, or is it his personal Twitter account in a personal capacity? And in fact, the president's own press secretary has made this more complicated because in a recent statement, he said the president is the president of the United States. Again, that logic is just perfect. It's flawless. To say the whole statement, the president is the president of the United States, so they're considered official statements by the president of the United States. That was about Trump's tweets. So he's claiming that these tweets are official statements of the president of the United States. Thus, would it indicate that it would be illegal for the president to block people on Twitter? Bueller? James?
It's kind of like, yeah, you could argue that, but I just don't want to concede to that bullshit logic. Here's the thing. You can kick people out of meetings, right?
Yeah.
But I guess because it's sort of this public service, I guess what they're saying is that you cannot kick someone out of a town hall meeting without due process of law because that is a right of some kind to show up to the town hall and hold your representative accountable.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, I have a question based upon what James is saying. It's about how the Twitter functionality. So why is somebody who's got that many followers and that many replies taking the time to block people? Like, don't you have better fucking time? There's better shit to do with your time. And is Trump the one actually blocking people? Or is it just someone's running his account and the people they find annoying, they're blocking? I just don't understand what the purpose is if you have that many followers. Like, I get it. Like, someone like me who, like, every once in a while, like, I set off, like, the Christian Batman versus Superman fans who insist that Superman is Jesus and Batman versus Superman. So I had to start blocking the responses I would get because they would come in, like, well, I don't know, once every 15 minutes or once every 10 minutes. Like, and it went away after 2 hours. So I can understand someone like me blocking people because it's like, I don't want to deal with this. But when you're Trump and you're getting negative shit all day, every day, how is it even worth the time to block anyone?
Well, because he's Donald Trump and he's a wild, wild narcissist. So there's that. But two, I suspect it's his staff, mostly.
And didn't they, like, shouldn't you fire your entire staff then? Like, if I were, like, a super celebrity, I would be like, okay, guys, we have a rule. Don't block anyone. And they'd be like, why? They hate you. Yeah, but that's a PR nightmare if you block them, guys. Just don't do it. Like, you have so many followers. Why are you highlighting one? That's not the word I'm looking for, but singling one out. That's what I'm looking for. Why are you singling one out by blocking them? Yeah. Because they use the hashtag fake leader? Like, there are people calling you a rapist and you're not blocking them?
Maybe he is. I don't know. As someone who does digital media for a living, I will say that there's a pretty simple argument on how you get around this, basically, which is, one, you could just create a different account and talk to the president that way, or two, log out of Twitter. If you log out of Twitter, you can see all the president's tweets. Boom. The end.
Yep.
End of lawsuit. But it's not the end of our discussion of the resistance. No, indeed not. In fact, a new comic named Cal Exit, that's a comic book, in fact, Cal Exit, sees California rebelling against President Trump.
Yes, is this where Superman's dad just says, ah, fuck it?
God. The presidency of Donald Trump has certainly been eventful so far. The day after Trump was inaugurated, there were mass protests. But now there's a new comic book for the Resistance. Cal Exit is a new comic from Black Mass Studios, and it portrays a near-future world in which the state of California is in open rebellion against the Trump-led U.S. government. Militants clad in Black Block. What is that? What is Black Block, James?
That's where they wear the a black hoodie and then welding goggles and then bandana over the face. Oh. That's the look. I actually want to put on this look for Aaron, so I can be the bad guy.
Gotcha. Militants clad in Black Block openly clash with federal troops to defend immigrants. Painkiller addiction is widespread and environmental decay is clear. Writer Matteo Pizzolo and artist Amanke Nahulapan combine these elements. I don't know why we still have me do the news. I've never successfully said a foreign person's name correctly on this entire show for 5 years. Combine these elements to create a dystopia that feels far closer than many readers will probably be comfortable with. The first issue of Cal Exit is out this week. Justin, will you be getting this signed at Comic-Con?
No.
Oh.
What? There's a great pod right there.
All
right,
it's time for the hopeful romantic with JML.
I mean, the description of these troops or these people makes it sound like California in this comic just becomes Antifa. Isn't that what they're describing?
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's insane,
hilarious,
right?
If they get their ass if they decided to fight against the rest of the country. Like, they'd lose if they fought against, like, angry hicks out in the wilderness in, like, Washington State.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what I really want to address and I want to bring up, because we haven't really addressed this Cal Exit movement before on the show. This has popped up since the election, where people were starting to be like, California is going to secede. And I started making the joke, yeah, I'm going to help them. And then once they do, I'm going to jump ship to go back to America. Like, and then, Daniel, you made a great joke. Do you want to say what you think the better name would be for
Well,
the
yeah,
movement?
My least favorite thing about Cal Exit has nothing to do with California leaving the union. That I'm totally for. My least favorite thing about Cal Exit is that it's named Cal Exit. The much better name from a marketing standpoint is Cal-Eve.
Yeah, like, why would you not do that? Because California people just hop on the train of what's already trendy, and they're like, oh, well, it's Brexit, so we're just going to call it Cal Exit. Like, fuck off. This is how stupid you are. This is how stupid you are, and you think you're better than everyone. And then you have the audacity to say, when we say bye, see you later, good luck, we hope you do it, you go, no, the rest of the country depends on us. Have you guys heard this argument?
Yes.
The argument that, California's economy is so large that the rest of the states depend on them. But I think it's exactly what James said. They don't realize that if they left, they would be the ones who fell apart, and the rest of the country doesn't fucking need them.
Yeah, it would be... it is sort of a situation where the trade between California and the states is a net positive for the other states versus California. But once you take away the sort of mechanism of interstate commerce that the United States provides, they would be totally fucked. They would just be totally, totally fucked.
Really?
And how much would it hurt the other states?
I mean, it would hurt net overall because, you know, the amount of money the government gets out of California in taxes is more than it puts in welfare. But the state itself is propped up by a lot of the trade from other states, is what I'm saying. So, yes, the United States would sort of have a net loss in terms of overall revenue, but the state itself, the actual machinations of the state California government would be totally fucked without free trade among the other states.
Right, and the point I'm making is, I agree with what you're saying about California, but it also, even though it would hurt, it wouldn't destroy the rest of the states. The rest of the states are not dependent on California, correct?
No, it would not. It would not. I'm not sure there's anything that we get from California that we couldn't get somewhere else. Pretty
sure.
We
already get all our Mexicans direct from Mexico, so what are you guys providing us?
Douchey leftist media moguls.
If California left... what type of country would it be? Are we thinking Europe? A European-style socialist country? Or do you think it would be worse?
I think it would be...
tough question.
I think it would be a tiny bit worse than that, but it wouldn't get much worse than that because it sort of already is what it's going to be. The California legislature has a supermajority Democrat. They can do whatever they want. And they've looked at I mean, they've done a lot of terrible shit with the state. And they've even looked at a single-payer healthcare system that would cost two times as much as their current revenues, their current total revenue.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So I think if they went independent, there'd be this movement to do a lot of the stuff like the single payer and confiscate guns. So I think it would be a little bit worse than a European sort of quasi-socialist state. It would just fail faster. So.
And because it would fail, would California even stay together? Or I think this is one of the premises in the comic itself, in the interview, that wouldn't it then break into several sub-factions? Like, wouldn't Orange County fight everyone else? And then, like, San Diego would be its own, and then Orange County, and then L.A., and then NorCal? Wouldn't we have all these different, like, sub-factions fighting each other within California?
I don't know. Take it a little far. I think instead of sub-factions, it'd just be mass exodus. There'd just be a lot of people leaving California, especially the more conservative parts of the state, like Orange County or Northern California, except for San Francisco. Like, I think a lot of them would leave. Yeah, I don't know.
It's interesting that you say that, yet they stay now, and I'm the hypocrite, but...
They do stay now, but it's completely different situation if you have to have a passport and there isn't free trade among the other states. It's a very different situation.
Yeah, I mean, me right now, California's shittiness doesn't really affect my job. I've managed to have a career that doesn't really get regulated or even very heavily taxed by the California system. But, you know, if they started banning guns and just the overall economy started to crash, yeah, I'd leave.
Yeah. All I'm saying, California, is... I'm open for consulting business. I don't want my name on anything, but I'm happy to consult. That's all I'm saying.
On the Cal-Eve movement?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, when we're talking about California and what it provides to the rest of us, one of the exports we have to talk about is Hollywood. Mm. So let's do that in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Couple quick reviews here to start off this week. The first one's going to be really quick, and the second one's going to be a little bit more substantial. But both of them, I think, are prime examples of exactly what Hollywood in California is exporting. So let's start off here with The Handmaid's Tale. Daniel, you're going to review it because you said you watched a few episodes on Hulu. And I want to transition this into a little bit of a discussion of the Emmys because I signed into Hulu this week to watch it. At work, because I sometimes put it on in the background and I like see what wrestling episodes there are. And when I sign in, a big banner at the top is like nominated for 13 Emmys, The Handmaid's Tale. And I'm just like, fuck, really?
So I haven't just watched a few episodes. I've watched the whole show.
What? I didn't know that.
It's only 10 episodes, so it's not. I mean, it's not that enormous of a commitment.
45 minutes each, though, right?
Something like that, but when you're doing other things and you're eating pistachios, it goes by pretty quick.
All I know is from now on, when I call you and you don't answer, I'm just going to leave voicemails that be like, fucking, you're going to watch The Handmaid's Tale and not answer the goddamn phone? You're telling me watching The Handmaid's Tale is more interesting than conversation with me? Fuck you. Hit pause on Elizabeth Moss and pick up the goddamn phone, you fucking asshole. That's going to be my voice messages to you from now on.
So when you call me 96 times a day, I have to answer every single time?
That's not true. You're exaggerating. You're right, only 94. 95.
Right. Okay.
Same joke.
So here we go. The plot of The Handmaid's Tale, in case anyone doesn't know, is based off a Margaret Atwood book from the 80s. It is a dystopian future, although not that distant a future, where because of, I think the show says, like, rampant sexually transmitted diseases and environmental pollution, birth rates have collapsed around the world, and people just can't get pregnant. Most people can't get pregnant, except for some chicks in America. why? We never get an answer to why they can still get pregnant, but they can. Basically, what happens then, according to the culture, is this crazy Christian totalitarian government forms and kidnaps all these women, holds them hostage, and basically makes them incubators for the society's great leaders' children. So they basically have to go through these horribly ritualistic sex acts, which are rape, unequivocally, and their whole lot in life is to have children for these theocrats. Additionally, the reason that this theocratic government named Gilead is allowed to exist is because they're basically trading these babies with the rest of the world. Basically, the chief export of the United States becomes kids.
Japan.
That's right. Looking at you, Japan. Buy our kids. Now half off. June Osborne is the main character in this show. She is played by Elizabeth Moss, and she is renamed Offred, or of Fred, because she belongs to Fred Waterford, one of the high commanders in Gilead. And it follows her journey, sort of, and her flashbacks to being a normal person, having a child, living in the country that was sort of slowly deteriorating. And it's the story of her being constantly pissed off and doing mostly nothing about it. That is basically this TV show in a nutshell. The good things about the show, which I'm tired of saying, really, because it's basically the good things about any modern TV, is that it looks stunning.
Yeah.
The production value is through the roof. The camera work is phenomenal. A lot of the directing is top-notch, some of the best TV directing I've ever seen. And then, like a broken record here, the bad part is that there's no fucking plot. It is not a show that consists of people in situations acting to overcome them or not. It is a show that is basically an incredibly well-produced documentary. And I hate this movement in television. We have stunning-looking cinematography and directing. We have even interesting setups. Like, this is an interesting concept. It's, you know, very anti-religion. It's very anti-male. It's very down on men. Fine, you can do those stories in a fascinating way, except that the character, the lead character here, is basically just, she's mad about her situation. She wants to go back to her previous life, but she doesn't know what to do, so ultimately she doesn't really do anything. Things just happen to her. Weird, interesting, new situations happen to her, and then she either likes them or she doesn't. And so, like, I literally watched the last episode of this, and then I was so unaware that it was the season finale that I kept trying to find the next one that I actually had to Google, like, when is episode 11 coming out? Because there's no ending. It just sort of, the show just stops. Like, it just stops happening. You're like, oh, that was interesting. The last episode. Okay, well, I guess I'll wait for next season. Like, okay. So the show is really critically acclaimed. I know why, because we're in this culture where it's cool to hate on men and it's cool to hate on religion. And I like hating on those things too. But nonetheless, this show is wildly overrated in terms of plot. The acting is good. The sort of setting is good. Like the background setting is an interesting world. Cinematography is clearly through the roof, but it's a show where nothing fucking happens. It's just a documentary. So I can't recommend it.
That is how the book was, by the way. I actually had the privilege of reading the book in college. The white privilege, of course.
So, James, before we go into the concretes here that Daniel's talking about the religion-hating and the man-hating, and I do want to talk about that, because if you look at the Emmy nominations, you notice a trend. I want to ask you about the culture and about this trend we're seeing, because I would say it extends beyond television. This idea that we have this wonderful technology now, and I think maybe we can say the first of this sort of nature was Avatar, where the technology in that is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
But the creative side of that, as far as the writing and the ideas behind it, is just shit. And what I'm asking is this just a result of our culture that we're going to continue to have beautiful things as far as from a technical standpoint, because the technology has far surpassed our philosophy and our ideas, because our ideas are shit, so that's manifesting.
Yeah, I mean, this has been civilization for a while, is that we... Our ability to manipulate the physical matter of reality is far past our ability to figure out values. And it's just, we have the science of the modern day, but the morality of the Middle Ages, basically, still. We just don't take it very seriously. So as a result, you know, generally the best you're gonna get is something like Breaking Bad, where it's very good romantic, but it could only take you so far because it doesn't have a life-affirming message. It has, you know, this isn't to criticize Breaking Bad, it's just that every actually legitimately good show, like Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, in my own, I actually have a classification scheme for different senses of life, and they're all very negative senses of life. Actually legitimately good shows. I'm not talking about Handmaid's Tale. I'm talking about, you know, House of Cards I consider very legitimately good. They all have the exact same sense of life, which is a very negative classification one. And not that it's bad, but it's not the highest possible. It doesn't raise you up and inspire you to be more as a person. And the closest I think we get to that in our culture right now is Christopher Nolan. Lacking, I think. Not that he's lacking, but Christopher Nolan is not the highest possible state of existence. He is I call him the gritty hero. Like, there's a hero, man is good, the universe is intelligible, but the universe is a hard place to live in, and happiness is very hard to come by. And that's the best we can do right now. So I definitely think that that is a phenomenon that is happening right now.
Okay, well, thank you for your grand unified theory of, like, all art and, like, that Christopher Nolan is the highest form of it. We can disagree on the concrete.
He's the highest form right now.
I understand what you're saying.
Think of if they made an Atlas Shrugged movie that actually, you know, did it justice. It would blow Christopher Nolan out of the water.
Yes, and we all know who should direct that, but that's another discussion. We can discuss the concretes all day, and we can talk about that. But your abstract point is well taken. And when you talk about this middle-aged morality, I think all we have to do is look at the Emmys to see we're really just substituting concretes for our morality, and it's almost virtue signaling is our morality. If you look through the nominees, it's all minority, trans, woman. And it's all this stuff they have to nominate. And I look no further than the nomination of San Junipero as the best episode of Black Mirror Season 3. And the only reason that episode got hype was because it was about an interracial lesbian elderly relationship. And it was about virtual reality enabling that. That's not a false description. I'm not even going over the top. That's how funny it is. Hmm. But that's the only reason that's hyped. That is a bad episode. The best episode, or one of the best, I mean, we can argue all day, but my favorite was the Bryce Dallas Howard episode about social media. And that was romantic, but no one talks about that episode at all. Instead, we talk about this one, which hits all the check marks. But people do it because it makes them look good to say it, and they become a moral person by saying it. But it was boring to watch.
Yeah. You can tell, for instance, you know, that The Handmaid's Tale was going to hit all the right boxes because this whole thing about society being sexist, bigoted, whatever, was ramped up with the election of the recent president. And in fact, the Wikipedia page says that parallels could be drawn between the series and American society following Donald Trump's and Mike Pence's election as president of the United States and vice president of the United States, respectively. Parallels could be drawn. This is a world where women are literally forced to have sex for religious people so that we can sell their babies to Mexico.
I mean, that's not disconnected from reality.
And there are parallels between the election of Donald Trump and this show? Okay.
That's what I was asking at the top. Well, that's what I was saying in the Trump blocking story where they're suing him. Like, like, why are these people so disconnected from reality that they're obsessed in this way, that they'll apply anything backwards to it? It's sick. It is sick. It makes me, that is the number one thing that makes me want to support Trump. I won't, and it's why I didn't vote in the election, because I won't, because I don't like him as a leader, but it's the number one thing that makes me want to support him, because if I go, well, my choices are, and I, you know, I said this in the fat shaming rant I went on about the Make America Eat Again. If my choices are Make America Eat Again or Make America Great Again, I'm not going to go with the fucking nutcase. If you're forcing me to choose, I'm not going to go with you people.
Yeah. Well, no one should go with The Handmaid's Tale. You should maybe watch an episode to see what the cultural hype is about, but after that, just get out. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't get any better than the first episode, so just leave while you can.
Right. And if they're serious about this whole trans thing and this whole representational thing, in the show The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, I want to see them add a male-to-female trans character into that league in The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, if they're really serious about this movement. But you won't ever see them do that. The next thing I want to talk about is The Big Sick. This is the movie written by Kumail Nanjiani, the comedian, and his wife, about how they fell in love, and eventually, you know, now they're married, and Kumail's having a successful career. He was on Franklin and Bash. He's on Silicon Valley. I've seen him do stand up in L.A. He's a funny guy. He's successful, and of course, he's also all over Twitter. And I had to unfollow him because he's super, as we were just saying, super anti-Trump and super social justice warrior, which is interesting to me considering his background, which is brought out in this movie. And if you remember, this is also a movie that we talked about on Trailer Takedown. Do you guys remember talking about it on Trailer Takedown?
Yeah.
Yes. I remember now. Kind of funny Ray Romano joke.
Right. And I believe we all hugged it.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Well, James, you were the one who was correct not to hug it. Because if...
I didn't tackle it, per se. I was just like, eh.
Okay, well, I was giving you credit, so if you want to shit on your own point, go ahead.
I shit on everything on this show, Justin, so why stop at you and Daniel?
That's right. Fair. If you want to have your German Scheisel video with yourself, like, that's fine. But... this is an if you ever want to see naturalism in a film, watch this film. I think I deserve an award for making it through this entire movie. Because there was a point where I was watching this and I was going, this is naturalism. I should probably just get up and leave at this point. But I did pay for it, so I'm just going to sit here and watch it. But I always think it's pretty stupid to get up and leave because you wasted your money. And, you know, like I said, the people who got up during Lady in the Water were like, oh, she said the blue world, I'm going to leave. Because usually people leave for stupid or offensive reasons, right? They're like, oh, well, I'm offended, so I'm going to leave. But this is legitimately like I knew exactly what it was. It was naturalism. And what I mean by that is literally every time a character is about to make a choice, they cut around it and cut back to whatever the result of that choice was. So the best example I can give you is... Kumail is dating Emily, and then they break up because he won't tell his mom that he doesn't want to do the Pakistani arranged marriage thing, which, Daniel, there is a conversation I want to have with you or ask your insight on this in a second. But, so he won't do it. They break up, and then he gets a call in the middle of the night that Emily's in the hospital. So he rushes over there, and no one's there to help her except him. And the doctor says, we need to put her in a medically induced coma because she has a rapidly spreading infection. And if we don't, she could lose her life. You're her husband and you want her to do this coma, right? And then Kumail's just like, what? What's going on? And the doctor's like, I'm telling you, she needs to be in this coma. And as her husband, you want her to be in this coma, right? And then he hands him the clipboard and he picks up the pen. And then it cuts to her in the coma. You don't even see the moment of him deciding. So this is literally just a movie about him reacting to everything that's going on. And so if you just want to see naturalism as a movie, that's what it is. And it's not that the acting's bad. And I mean, the directing is uncreative because it's just a straight comedy. So it's almost shot like a high budget sitcom. So I wouldn't say visually it's great, but it's also not technically bad. The cinematography is not bad. It's exactly what, Daniel, you were just talking about. So the technology is good, but the ideas are awful. So from a purely artistic standpoint, this isn't worth anything. Like, this is like, it's almost a 0 out of 10 because it's pure naturalism.
But like not even watching a movie.
Well, I mean, you are watching a movie, so maybe it's a 1 out of 10, but it's hard to even rate it. Because it's like, if anyone ever wants to say to me, well, what is naturalism? I don't understand what naturalism. I will literally just point to this movie. And that's what raises interesting things to me culturally and the way people are. And there are examples in this movie where it's sort of like, wow, this is revealing of the culture. And it's also revealing of what we get from movies. So the first thing I want to talk about is the scene where he finally confronts his parents about the whole arranged marriage thing. You could argue that this is a scene where he is finally making a choice. Mm-hmm. But he's not, because his parents find out about everything. And before he goes over to, I believe she just woke up, and before he goes over there to see Emily, his parents come over and confront him. And they come to his apartment. And they're like, you know, we're ashamed of you. Why will you not do this arranged marriage thing? What's wrong with you? And the scene is very moving. And the scene is very moving to an objectivist, to someone who, like me, who believes in the virtue of selfishness, because he says the proper arguments. And then the response is it's like Rand wrote the responses. He says that, he goes to them, why did you bring me to America if you don't want me to have an American life? He says that literally. And it's basically like, why are you still being Islamic if you came here and are saying this is better? And then the dad literally replies to him in the way a Randian villain would. He literally says, you're being selfish. You're only thinking of yourself. You're not thinking of your mom. You're not thinking of your religion. You're not thinking of your family. You're only thinking of yourself. And in that scene, as a microcosm, I was like, wow, this is a really good scene. But the only reason he even had this moment with them is because they made it so uncomfortable for him that he had to address it. So basically, it's still emotionalism, because the discomfort at not addressing it became worse than the discomfort for addressing it. Does that make sense?
He didn't take an active stand for his values. Like, he only realized his values once his surroundings shoved him into a position where he had to.
Right, where it wasn't about choosing positively, it was about avoiding the most discomfort, is the way I would say what you just said, James.
At least he still made an argument.
Well, right, no, and that's what I'm saying.
That scores a lot of, I'm not saying it was good, but like, that scores a lot of, so many times in movies, they don't want to offend anyone or some stupid shit like that, and the protagonists, they'll do things and they won't give any explanation. Like, a good example of this is Captain America in Captain America Civil War. It's like, okay, like, you know, Captain definitely has his arguments for feeling the way he feels, but there's no explanation whatsoever, and the scene where he is supposed to explain it, it's like, well, I just think we do it, or I don't even remember what he said. It was shit!
Right, well, that's the difference between the pop music version of naturalism and this, which is like pseudo-intellectual naturalism. Because the point is, from an artistic standpoint, they're still not choosing to emphasize his choice making, his choices. They're still doing everything they can to de-emphasize that, and it's just pure emotionalism. And so that makes me wonder what the audience is getting from this. And this is sort of, Daniel, where I want to share my experience and then also transition into, because you're in an interracial relationship with a former Muslim.
What?
So I think...
Yeah.
Like, you're shocked at that. So I think there's some stuff that, like, I almost want you guys to see it to see what your reaction would be, but I also don't want you to suffer naturalism. But here's the thing, like, I think it's like, you know how they talk about, and Dr. Drew talks about this often on the Adam and Drew podcast, about how people will repeat their trauma?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's almost like embracing naturalism is a way of just repeating your trauma. It's like you're seeking it out again, and you get this short-term relief and comfort by being like, oh, I'm not the only one who's experienced that. Because for me, it was like what I dealt with my ex in her relationship with her mother, where her mother was super religious and Filipino, so she was never going to accept me. So it always caused this tension with my ex and I. So I'm watching the scene where Emily's just like, I'm going to leave. I can't do this anymore because, you know, you can't own up to your values and everything. And I'm like, oh, okay, you know, other people have experienced that. And it gave me a measure of an emotional response, but it also didn't seem to me healthy to be doing that because it's sort of like I've moved on from this. I know it's bad. Why do I need to watch this on the screen? So it almost seems like we're embracing naturalism as a culture and we're embracing just pure emotionalism in movies as a culture because we're just coping with trauma we've experienced.
Okay, well, if you're going to mass psychologize, might as well. I don't want to necessarily say it's about trauma. I'll say very broadly that naturalism, you know, evokes people's sense of life in the same way that romanticism does. Just it's the sense of life of people we would never hang out with, right? It's people who believe that that their goals are unattainable. It's people who think that the universe is out to get them, or that happiness isn't possible, or that life is just pain and misery and horror and tough. You know, it's hard. Like life is just hard. That's all it is. And this satiates their sense of life. This basically says to them, yes, the world is exactly as you think it is, which is terrible. Congratulations.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was just sort of delving deeper into...
Stop it.
Why they have that sense of life. But that's a whole other... I mean, you're not going to like that because you don't like the psychologizing. But
I don't know. Actually, psychologizing might be perfectly okay in the field of art because art is going to appeal to a mass psychology or a mass philosophy. So the people who, you know, the people who find those sorts of movies compelling, you know, they are that way by the fact that they found those movies compelling. They are that way psychologically.
Yeah. So there you go, Daniel. But
nope.
And the question about the Islamic thing is like, so obviously I've never like encountered it firsthand. So this is like the closest I've come and everything. And I don't know the interactions you've had with your wife's family, but like
they none, kept right?
pretty close to none, as close you can get to none without actually being none.
Okay. Then maybe we need to have her on the show and interview her about this, but they kept having family dinners where they would sit him down and then like literally a woman would come in and they'd be like, oh, she just stopped by. And they talk to the woman, and then she would give him like a headshot with like literally headshots have your resume on the background. And it was very similar to that. And the mother would just keep setting up these meetings to arrange the marriages between him and these women. Is that accurate?
I would say it's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but exaggeration just for humorous stylization, I suspect. But there is something that it's more that more so goes on in Indian families, maybe some Pakistani families, but certainly much more in Indian. But like, you know, when I was first dating Faiza, like her parents would have over a guy for dinner that they wanted her to be with. I mean, it was never me, by the way, but you know, that happens. It's sort of like an interview. Luckily Faiza basically just told him to fuck off every single time. So that's nice. But, so it does happen, you know, if you get a headshot and a resume, that's probably just comedic effect, but, it's not totally untrue.
Yeah. So it's just interesting to me. It was interesting to me to watch it. And when he said the thing, like, why do you come to America and not want me to have an American life? And then I'm just like, he wrote this movie with his wife. So it's like, if you're writing that and you're understanding that, what premises are you also missing to get to being this like annoying social justice warrior on Twitter, you know?
Right. Yeah, I'd be curious what his reaction would be to like the criticism of the movie from like Jezebel, which was something like, I'm tired of watching brown men fall in love with white women on movies or something like that.
Gods.
Yeah. I'd be curious
to
know what he thought of that.
They always find a way, don't they, Jezebel?
Oh, yeah. They're the worst. They're the new Gawker.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, no, 100%. So to summarize before we go into trailer takedown here, it's naturalism, but if you ever want a snapshot of where our culture is right now, I think this movie is a fascinating sort of academic, if you look at it academically, academic approach to where we are artistic and culturally right now.
Yeah, between this and MJ apparently from Spider-Man.
I mean, MJ would fit right in. And did you see, brief tangent, did you see that they came out this week and said, you know, she's not Mary Jane Watson, so I don't know why people are getting upset? It was just a nice little nod to the comic's history. So now they're playing semantic games. It's like, no, you were redoing the character differently, but now there's such a backlash that you might actually put Mary Jane Watson in there.
Huh. Did that with the Shocker.
Oh, there.
No, I mean the character. You know the dude who kept punching stuff with his...
Yeah, like, the Shocker was one of the minor characters, and just like the other
right,
person
who
helped...
Right, but then they vaporized his ass. So the idea is, it's like, okay, we're going to pay tribute to the existence of that character, but they're not going to have a major role.
Right, I understand that, but you don't cast a major actress and name her character MJ if you don't intend for her to go forward because they want to have multiple sequels.
I didn't know she was a major actress.
Yeah, she's huge with the Disney audience. Mm. That's who they were marketing this film towards.
Yeah.
Just Google her. Even. All right, let's move on.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
The Emoji Movie. And if you are following us on social media, you will see that I posted these trailers on Thursday. So if you ever want to, ahead of time, see all these trailers, you can just look at our Facebook page or look at themidside.com around noon on Thursday, and it'll be up so you can get a preview and understand what we're talking about. But the Emoji Movie isn't actually the trailer, it's the opening scene. And it basically shows, hey, you know, a high school freshman's phone on the inside of it, and every emoji has a role. This is very similar to Wreck-It Ralph. The premise is very similar to Wreck-It Ralph. And there's one emoji, the meh, played by TJ Miller, which has a very hard time being meh because the world is just so exciting. Daniel?
Yeah. So I will say that the movie had a better premise than I thought from the title. So, I mean, the Emoji Movie sounds terrible. But this, I mean, at least the premise as given in the introduction is a tiny bit more interesting than that. It's like the inside world of your phone. So it's kind of, yeah, Wreck-It Ralph came to mind, or like Monsters, Inc. or whatever, where like there's a setup universe and these are characters within the universe. That being said...
Yeah, you could argue Wreck-It Ralph got its premise from Monsters, Inc. to begin with.
Yes, indeed. That being said, hard tackle.
Tackle!
Looks terrible. Jokes didn't land for me. I have no interest in watching a meh emoji learn that it's okay to be not meh. Like, that's... Because that's going to be the movie, so...
Are you sure it's not going to be the opposite? Like, I mean, Wreck-It Ralph had the opposite, where ultimately it was everyone has their role and you have to learn your role to contribute to society. What if he learns that he has to be meh because that's his role?
Yeah, I don't see it going that direction. It's, I mean, Wreck-It Ralph is what it is, but I suspect this is going to be like, you can be more than whatever it is that's prescribed to you because being meh is bad. I don't know.
Wouldn't it be better if the movie was about self-determination and the emojis are born, I don't know, tabula rasa, and then they become whatever emotion they most
or
are?
Or we could make a movie about something other than an emoji.
I didn't even get to all of this, all of these considerations, because I just can't get to, I just couldn't get past the hate about some movies where they try to be quote unquote relevant, like, ooh, let's make a movie about the facts that teenagers are texting each other, and they show this picture of people running into each other because they're texting, all the high school kids are ramming into each other while walking because they're texting one another. Ah, get over your fucking selves. I've taught high school kids in the modern day. They use their phones, but come on. Like, they're not as obsessed with them as these, I don't know, socialite people want us to believe. They're like, oh my god, they're using their phones so much. Like, oh my god. Like, even if it were true, like, it doesn't matter. At least they're not, you know, snorting drugs.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I don't know. I can't even put my finger on what I hate about that. When someone tries to be relevant, like, oh, get it? We made a movie about emojis. Like, we understand teenagers.
So is that a tackle?
Yeah, it's just plus, the tackle of the whole premise. Tackle.
Plus, by the way, young people are on to snaps and stickers now, so fuck your emojis.
Yeah, yeah, and this movie is, like, a good 5 years behind, too.
Yes.
All right, well, I am also tackling, just because even beyond the premise problems, the execution just looks awful.
Tackle.
My colon, I'm an emoticon.
I thought that was kind of funny, but that was the only thing that was... And I felt like, okay, I was slightly entertained by this 2 minutes. Now I don't have to watch the movie.
Right. From this point forward, you mean there's another hour to go? There's another hour of this? Yeah.
It's like one of those SNL sketch comedies where it was like they base the entire thing on one joke, and after about 30 seconds, you're like, okay, well... That panned out. I'm done watching this now.
Oh, what was the fucking SNL thing they did with the Night at the Roxbury? It's like another Will Ferrell movie. It's like, this is barely tolerable for 2.5 minutes, one Saturday a month. Anyway, okay.
Second trailer.
Goon, Last of the Enforcers, is a sequel to a hockey movie called Goon, starring Sean William Scott. And really? In this movie, yes, you didn't realize that there was a sequel?
Is that why I didn't get any of the jokes?
Maybe. I actually haven't seen the original. I will explain in a minute why I included this. But Goon, The Last of the Enforcers, is about the comeback of Sean William Scott's career. He's a enforcer in hockey, so this is a very physical player who dominates on the ice and, you know, sort of helps his team out in that way. But he suffered a major injury, and then someone else takes over as a star player of his team. So he retrains himself to get back out there and become the leader of his professional team again. The reason I included this is written and directed by Jay Baruchel, who is a personal favorite of mine. He's great in Man Seeking Woman. He was in one of Daniel's favorite movies. He was the star of She's Out of My League. And also, he is a big defender of Batman versus Superman. So, for me personally, it's a sports movie. It's good to see Sean William Scott again in a role that's more serious and not just gross out. And based upon the talent behind the camera, I'm going to hug this.
Hug.
Really? Fine. You have good reasons. I have some of those reasons, except that I watched this trailer and was bored to tears for a 3-minute short, so not sure I could do that for any longer. Jokes didn't land for me. I had no idea what was going on. Nominally interested in this sort of coming back hockey story, but when I found out his entire injury was simply that he must now punch with his left hand instead of his right, done. That's the extent of his injury. Done. Like
I'm assuming that was just in the trailer. I'm hoping the injury is a little more complicated than that.
Honestly, I thought his injury was a brain injury because the scene after his injury, like he's at a birthday party and he looks mildly retarded in that scene. No, and so I thought
brain injury because now he can't move certain limbs the same way because his neurons are all fucked up.
That would be wildly more interesting than what was shown in the trailer. So,
well, I think that's what they were implying with the trailer, and I think punching with the left was just one step he had to take in order to recover.
Okay, because he hired a bum to teach him how to punch.
And I like hockey, so...
I'm out. I'm tackling.
Tackle.
I'm hugging, but I'm hugging it at home.
Hug. Final trailer.
Darkest Hour is a... Fuck. Can't remember his name. I'm thinking, for some reason, I always confuse Winston Churchill and Alfred Hitchcock. Don't ask me why.
No, that makes perfect sense given this fucking movie.
Yes, in your brain folders of concepts, that makes awesome sense, but it's a hilarious mix-up.
So yes, this is about, it's a biopic, because I was about to say it's a biopic of Gary Oldman as Alfred Hitchcock, and I was like, wait, that's not right. It's a biopic of Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill.
Very good.
And here's what I like about this trailer. I like the aesthetic of this trailer, and I'm not saying I like it because it's dark and gritty, but I like that they didn't just do like a naturalistic approach to it, that they stylized it. Everyone out there should know by now that I love stylization in movies. I will appreciate that in movies and television stylized. And I like the stylization they did here. And I think it fits the way they're portraying how Churchill came in and saved England, basically. I'm not sure about, because I don't really know the history of Churchill that well. I'm not sure about that. It sort of seems like almost like Batman in the Dark Knight, where it's sort of like the hero they need, but not the hero they deserve. Where this whole idea that any true hero in our society, we have to have this guilt over having him. There seems to be a little bit of that in the trailer where it's like, we don't fucking like this guy, but he's our last resort type deal. So I'm going to say that I will hug this. I think it looks good. Gary Oldman's awesome, and he looks like he's going to be good in this. But the question I have to throw it to you guys is, were a lot of the quotes he said here actual Churchill quotes?
I have some amount of Churchill knowledge. I'm not any Churchill historian, but certainly the speech he gave is accurate. And I suspect the other quotes are probably attributed to him. Although he's a little bit like Mark Twain, where we've now just started to attribute really witty things to him that he never actually said. But
yeah, that's the Mike Birbiglia joke, where he's like, just attribute everything to Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. Indeed. So we get a little bit of that with Churchill, so can't necessarily verify, but Churchill was a very witty person. So I'm hella excited about this, and not just because this is the first trailer so far on the show that doesn't have TJ Miller in it.
That was unintentional. I got to, like, literally I put the trailers in, and then I watched them before the show, like 15 minutes before we recorded, and I got to the end of the Goon trailer and I go, wait, TJ Miller's in this movie? What the fuck?
Yeah. So I was expecting to see him like in the background or something, you know, Winston Churchill's retarded son or something. I don't know. But didn't happen. So that's awesome. Gary Oldman's awesome. I love Winston Churchill. I love this whole era of history. I'm in. I'm in like Flynn. Hug.
Hug.
This is a huge hug for me. This hug. Is so epic. Really think Winston Churchill's really this. This is also the gritty hero archetype for me, like Christopher Nolan. And by the way, Justin, Churchill was a flawed hero. Like just historically, he was. He made a huge fuck up in the Battle of Gallipoli in World War I, I believe. And
yeah, Galilee.
What's up?
Galilee? Did he try to fight Puff the Magic Dragon?
No.
Was it Gilead? Was he fighting for women's rights by fighting Gilead?
The Republic of Gilead. Yeah, nice memory there. But you just saw the film, so never mind. He was infamous as a politician who had had its ups and downs. And he really obviously came through in World War II. So that is the historical framing that the drama of his life takes. I'm really excited to see it. Also, by the way, the Battle of Dunkirk is also mentioned in this trailer. So we kind of have a Winston Churchill extended universe with Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk coming out here soon.
I don't think that's intentional, but okay.
I know it's not, but since they both seem like they're going to be very good films, I'm just going to pretend that they take place in the same universe, since they did.
Can you say the word hug for me?
Hug.
All right, now that we've talked about some stuff we actually liked, there was a trailer we actually liked this week, let's talk about some stuff that's going to annoy the shit out of us. It's time for Reddit on Reddit.
These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit. And I included this because there was a lot of talk about this on the interwebs this week. So I think it's important to address this topic. Sirius, what effect do you think yesterday's day of action has or will have on net neutrality laws?
Nothing. The end.
Right. It's another one of these marches they've been having all of this year, right? It's like, Trump was elected president. We don't like him. So let's hold a bunch of marches. But the deeper question I want to get at is, what is this obsession with net neutrality? Why are there some people who are so convinced that it's a good thing?
It's that if you government don't have net neutrality, the internet. So there are people who like when the government controls things and they think big bad corporations are evil and will fuck them over. So yes, of course, the government needs to step in and control the internet.
Yeah.
So what are the ways they think that the corporations are going to control them if government's not regulating.
So there are a couple things. One is like the concept of fast lanes, which is that an ISP can charge more money to someone for faster internet access that they're willing to pay, which they sort of already do now. That would be essentially obsolete if we enacted full-blown net neutrality. Other things like, the conversation about this came about because of the popularity of Netflix in a lot of ways, because at any given point, Netflix is using something like 50% of all bandwidth in the country, which is incredible. And actually, maybe there's a bit of history that I'm missing here, but I believe it was Netflix that started lobbying for net neutrality because they didn't want to basically be charged more for using that much more bandwidth. They wanted all information to be treated equally. And then the others is that people are starting to have this notion that ISPs, internet service providers, are going to start censoring content they don't like by basically, either slowing down speeds for websites they don't approve of, or charging them more money if they run hate groups, or, you know, it's not even hate groups in this scenario. It's, we think, Comcast won't like what the resistance is doing, so they're going to slow down Hillary Clinton's website speed access nonsense. We don't know what we're talking about. The problem with all that is that we've never had any examples of ISPs doing anything malicious at all in that regard. And even if they did, I wouldn't give a fuck. But we actually just don't have any examples. The people who are pro-net neutrality literally cannot point to one example of an ISP censoring people, slowing down speeds, or charging ridiculous amounts of money for internet access. So
right.
They did. Fuck off. That's their right. If I'm an ISP, I might decide to not run someone's Nazi site. That's my right.
Yes. Indeed. Totally. Right. I'm with you there. The practical point is just one that I like to throw in the left's face, because they talk about all these horrors and I say, well, when has that ever happened? And they go, well, it could. It could happen.
Right. And so. It could is an example of the projection of their own interpersonal hostility. What they're saying is if they ran the ISPs, they would censor sites they didn't like. So yeah. They're assuming other people would do that.
Yeah.
I think this interpersonal hostility comes from their desire to have a penis, even though they don't. None of them, including the men, don't have one. So, and I think, and we also have to consider their, their fascination with having sex with their own mothers, too. That might play a role.
Yeah, indeed.
Are you satirizing my psychologizing?
No.
Yes.
Yes, I don't know what he's doing. But what was I going to say? Oh, my least favorite thing about the net neutrality debate is okay. Well, it's not my least favorite thing is that we're talking about regulating the greatest invention in modern era. Let's not fucking do that, because the government fucks everything it touches. But, and it's immoral. But my least favorite thing is how fucking dishonest the net neutrality proponents are.
Right.
Insanely dishonest. So the core premise they start off with is that we currently have net neutrality, that the ISPs treat everyone equally and it's lovely, and all the government is doing now is enshrining that in law. They're just enshrining it in law, so we'll have net neutrality forever. And so when you say things like, I don't want net neutrality, well, that's what we have now. You're like, no, we have internet freedom now. We have a laissez-faire internet, which is why it's so fucking awesome. So yeah. I hate these people.
Next Reddit. People of Reddit, or people of the midside. What's something that your family or culture does that might seem strange to others? Now, I want to go first on this. Because apparently the answer for me is everything. Because, you can ask Daniel this. Like, we talk about the 94 times I call him a day. Like, very often I'll call him and I'll be like, is this really what people do? He's like, yes, this is normal. And I'm like, that's normal? And I'll be like, but that's not what my family did at all. And he's like, yeah, well, that's because your family's crazy. Like, so to me, it's like everything. And it's so bizarre to me that you can live in a world and like grow up. And this is sort of like the whole Camille thing, right? Like in the Big Sick, like you can grow up in this culture that's so insulated from the rest of the world, yet still exists and survive somehow.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't have a great answer to this question. My family has sort of had this institutionalized not doing things mentality. You know, like when I go home, when I used to go home on college breaks or whatever, like what we would do is nothing. Literally, it's like, do you want to go out to eat? It's like, eh. Do you want to go to Chicago? Like, we go to Chicago, go to the museums. Eh, why bother? No, why do that? Now, my aunt and uncle aren't like that, but my family is just sort of, my closer family is just sort of generally blech, just blech. And I don't know, that's not even strange around you. It's just sort of nothing. It's nothing. We don't have any special rituals. We don't have any, like, we never played fucking Elf on the Shelf or Hide the Pickle in the Tree or other weird Christmas traditions. You know, we're sort of just, blech. We're very Midwest. Midwest, ugh.
So it's interesting because my family's the same way. It's just sort of like I've told you before, like trips, like a trip with my family. If you go on vacation with my family, it's wake up, eat, sit around, eat, sit around and eat. And in between, you talk about what you're going to do to eat at the next meal. And it's just the most bizarre thing to me in the entire world. Like you're literally just laying around and eating all day. You don't do anything else. And I've never understood it. And it's depressing to me.
Yeah,
it makes me depressed.
The only thing I can think of is something that I don't really participate in, which is that at any sort of small family gatherings, there will be drinking, which is pretty normal. But at some point, people have had enough to drink that they will just share their most horrific memories from their childhood. And it's sort of like always the same memories being shared. And I don't participate because all of my childhood memories are wonderful. So
I have a self-affirming answer to this question. Something that my family does that other people might feel strange, talk shit about Justin and say he is an awful human being.
Oh, the timeless tradition. My family does that too, interestingly.
Talk shit about Justin?
That was the joke, yes.
It's a national pastime that I'm unaware of?
That's right. International right, James, talk shit about Justin question? Day.
James?
My thing is, I don't know how generally weird this is, but this is just something that my extended family and I do, is that, like, we like to, when House Elias is this extended family of, like, five families, and we all get together, we're all Elias, and we are very loud. We like to, like, I'm one of the quieter Eliases. Like, I'm known as, like, the introverted, old, calculating, intellectual weirdo Elias. Like, because the rest of the Eliases are just like, you know, one of our pastimes is I'm one of the older cousins, and what I would do is I would get in the faces of my my younger cousins, and then shake their shoulders and yell directly into their face like different Jack Bauer quotes. I like, tell me where the bomb is, or like, where is it, or you know, stop the madness. So we just, so that's the Elias tradition, is just being loud, being obnoxious in public places, being obnoxious to waiters, or just being loud, not obnoxious, but loud to waiters. Just like, oh, I don't know, it's hard, I'm just realizing this isn't very good pod because I can't communicate the context, but yeah.
Nah, the yelling Jack Bauer quotes at people is funny, grabbing them on the shoulder and yelling them, yeah, but I can picture that.
Elias is a loud and proud house.
Yeah, it also sounds like the first house eliminated in Game of Thrones.
No, we would be the last. We would be the last house standing, just from our sheer volume.
Last Reddit. What do people need to stop romanticizing? And I picked this for the podcast because it's kind of like, it's an interesting question for us, especially me, who, you know, I live life as a romantic. So why would I ever say stop romanticizing things? But here's the thing. Romanticizing has to be in line with reality. And there are actually a couple of things that... There was one we touched on in the show that Daniel talked about earlier. The idea of romanticizing how difficult it is to raise a baby and how much sleep you lose. And the reason something like that needs to be stopped romanticized, that we need to stop romanticizing that, is because it... it turns it into more of a harrowing ideal, harrowing ordeal than it is. And it takes the joy out of it. It's like, oh, look at how I'm suffering due to this. And it becomes this commiseration thing. When really, having a child and raising a child should be this amazing thing. So something like that needs to be stopped romanticized for that reason. Something else that came up was a status I posted this week. I talked about it with Daniel. I had to take NyQuil one night because I have a little bit of a head cold. I'm a little congested, and you know, you take NyQuil, it helps you knock things out earlier. And I made a post about, like, I don't know how people drink and do drugs because, like, I can't deal with how, you know, lethargic I am due to NyQuil this morning. And I've heard people talk about hangovers where they feel sick to their stomach, they have a headache, they can't move because they're achy. So I was making a joke based upon that. But then I learned from the responses that people were saying that NyQuil is the worst thing you can take. It's the most potent. Someone even called it worse than heroin. And Daniel said we have this thing in our society where we say that NyQuil's worse than it is. And I think we're doing that because we're romanticizing alcohol and drugs. Like, I, as a straight-edge person, I really think we romanticize alcohol as, like, that's what you do in your free time, and it's, like, this amazing thing that helps things socially. And it just becomes this crutch and this harmful toxin. And I'm using that intentionally because there are very few people who actually drink to enjoy the taste and enjoy the experience. It's always, you know, in this self-destructive way because we've romanticized it as that's the way we socialize and that's how we interact with people.
Dude, I'm going to get blasted. I'm going to get hammered. I'm going to get smashed. I'm going to get wasted.
Right.
Yes.
Right, exactly. And it's absolutely, like, it's cool, and that's what you do all week. You work to just do that on the weekend because you've romanticized it as this amazing thing. And, you know, I'm making fun of my family for saying all they do is talk about eating, and they wait until they eat the next time. Well, it's the same thing with drinking because it's been romanticized.
Yeah. That's a really good one. One, I'm going to list just a couple, and then I'm going to get into one that is going to be highly controversial, and I'll get lots of hate mail for. So, okay. So, so the ones that I'm going to list off, things like porn, you should probably stop romanticizing that. One from earlier in the show, breastfeeding. It's
stop romanticizing porn, like how bad it is?
Well, no. Well, as a culture, we're sort of just completely desensitized to it now. And in fact, there's, like, we even use porn sort of lightly and like, oh, that's grammar porn or that's such and such porn or, you know, whatever. Like, we've become completely like, oh, yeah, that's totally a normal part of everyday life. And it's like,
yeah, I hate that. Food porn?
Yeah. And it's like, like, I get this should all be legal. I'm not a hyper-Christian, whatever. But, like, you have to recognize that there are going to be negative consequences to this thing if you're engaging in it all the time, whatever it is. No free lunch in nature.
And the idea that posting a picture of, like, the food you ate is, like, the same as watching two people fuck, like, it's not anywhere near the same level of explicit. It's just sort of like, like you're saying, we're desensitizing ourselves to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that, breastfeeding, you know, there's this thing now where it's like, oh my God, if you don't breastfeed your child, you're basically abusing it. But, like, there's not a single study that shows that in any, even short term, that breastfeeding is any better for your child than bottle feeding.
That's why everyone should breastfeed during sex.
That's right. And then here's one, here's the controversial one that, I'm gonna have to say that I'm gonna try to say this very carefully, but we've really come to romanticize Down syndrome in our culture.
What?
Awesome.
Yes. This comes about all the time with Special Olympics or with various things where, you know, there's so many phrases that are like, oh, he's such a hero. He's brave. He's not disabled. He's differently abled. And, like, you know, I have acquaintances who have children with Down syndrome, and like the messages they write about them, where it's like, literally this one person said, like, if I could have chosen, I would have chosen for this child to have Down syndrome because they're such a blessing in my life. And it's like, that's horrific to me. Like, yes, we should treat people with Down syndrome with dignity and respect and sort of be inclusive with them as possible. But they're also not some sort of superhero. They don't have moral superiority. And in fact, they're living a diminished life versus someone without Down syndrome. So I feel like our romanticization of it is one, sick, and two, it actually doesn't do people with Down syndrome any good to do that.
Well, no, you're 100% correct. I think it's a great point when you're talking about the heroism of it. It's as if these are heroes, they're ideals of what a hero should be.
Yeah. Like, what an inspiration. Or one person I know in my newsfeed is trying to make it illegal. And this is a person who's a progressive, mind you. This person is trying to advocate making it illegal to have a Down syndrome selective abortion. Meaning, so like sex selective abortions are already starting to become illegal in various places. Meaning like if I have a girl but I wanted a boy, I'm having an abortion. Now if you find out your child has Down syndrome and that's why you choose to abort, that's going to be illegal. Or they're trying to make that illegal. I don't think it'll ever pass. But the point is that sort of support of that kind of thing to me is horrific. It's horrific. This person is living a diminished life, and this is not an ideal. We should not be holding this syndrome up as something that's inspirational and heroic. It's also not something to be ashamed of and demeaned, but we don't have to go the opposite direction either. Okay. Send hate mail to...
I agree with you on the principle. I just don't want to get into the abortion debate. That's a whole other debate.
So. I don't want to get into that debate either. My point is, like, this person who is otherwise hyper-progressive wants to make Down syndrome selective abortion illegal because they think basically Down syndrome is like this blessing.
Yeah. I get you. James, do you have an answer to this question?
I have a couple. I completely agree, Daniel. I'm really sick of just generally romanticizing victimhood. Yes. Or I guess they're not really victims, but it's just... those who are not as well off. It's just, well, you didn't do anything to become not as well off. I'm interested if you overcame your obstacles. That's something to be romanticized, whatever those obstacles might be. But yes. You got to overcome something first, for fuck's sake.
Yes.
And then we can romanticize you. One of the things that always pissed me off is the classic, you ever get this in college, like... This the classic college thing of, like, I tell someone about objective bond with, dude, I studied abroad, and then I realized there is no such thing as objective truth. Like, I started hearing a rash of that in college, and by the seventh guy who said that, like, I just kicked him and everyone else in the room in the nuts. Or at least I felt like doing so. It's just, oh my god, like, fuck you, like... And it comes from this place of, like, of you know, weird moral superiority. Like, oh, I'm truly morally superior because I don't believe in morals.
Yeah, absolutely.
And another one is mental illness in general, or not, and I'm not necessarily saying Down syndrome this time, but sort of more typical mental illnesses such as depression or anxiety. People, my friend is a comedian, and in his comedy group, they say, like, oh, well, I have depression. And what they're saying is that there's this sort of like almost pride in it, because the idea is like, oh, well, all great art comes from pain. And so I have so much pain, so my art must be so good. Get over your goddamn self.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something I can't stand either. The idea that art has to come from pain, that's existed for a very, very long time. I'd say that's a cognate of naturalism. All great points you guys have all made. All great, great points. So
it all came from pain. All great points come from pain, too.
So let's put a cap on this episode then. What did we learn this week, Daniel?
I learned that I am totally open to consulting for people I would otherwise hate, as long as those people then go further away from me.
James?
I feel like I learned a lot. There's just a lot of little... The thing that comes to mind right now is Daniel... It's just more about Daniel's relationship with Fiza. That's pretty epic that she just kind of... I feel like I learned more about how she sort of rejected her upbringing and just said, nope, going with Daniel.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
It's pretty awesome. That's why I married her. Oh, yeah. She's awesome.
I mean, you're kind of obligated to marry someone at that point. Like,
that's right.
Leave her in the gutter after that.
I accidentally arranged my own marriage. Yeah, Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that Winston Churchill and Alfred Hitchcock were the same person.
Well, Midsiders, we hope you learned something this week, too. And we'd be happy to hear about it on Twitter at The Midside or Facebook.com/TheMidside or any of the other Midside crazy social media places like Instagram, Snapchat, and I don't know. You want anything else? Is Vine still around? I think that's gone. So
there's the Zack Snyder social media called Vero.
Vero? Okay.
Yeah, it's like his friend runs it. So there's only like, he only has like 8,000 followers on it or something.
Oh, okay. Well, we're probably there.
Justin tries to get Zack Snyder's attention social media platform.
That's right. You can also go to the website, themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the old episodes. Lots of golden nuggets there. Learn about things like Pussy Comitatus and Schrodinger's blowjob and many other of our classic hits. So, you can also subscribe to get the latest episodes.
Why are two classic hits that you named like super sexualized?
I don't know, because that's what we do on this show.
Everything is sex, Justin.
Yeah. Hello, Dr. Freud. You can go to iTunes or Google Play, subscribe to get the latest episodes delivered directly to the listening device of your choice. It's not even our choice. It's your choice, which is nice. While you're at iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. We are growing. We want to surpass Welcome to Night Vale, who I think James saw an advertisement for out in public recently.
Yeah, I saw a dude with the shirt. I'm like, fucking Night Vale. And I punched him in the face and then ran and, or then said, welcome to the fucking Midside, and then I ran.
That's what we recommend.
As I ran, he waved
to everyone.
In the air. He said, damn you, Midside.
That's right. We said, so, first.
We're coming for you, Night Vale.
That's right. First, we took out Grantland. Now we're coming for you. That's right. You can help us do that by telling a friend about the show. Telling a friend is the number one way that your friends learn about the show. That's right. So tell a friend. If you would like to help us financially, you can go to patreon.com/themidside, and you can choose to give us money every time we produce a piece of content. Yes, so it's not like a monthly subscription where we just deduct money from your wallet, even if we are on vacation in Belize. No, in fact, it's only when we produce an episode that we deduct some amount of money, and that money is even your choice. Look at all these choices we're giving you. It's incredible. We're like the government. So yeah, you can choose like $1 an episode, 50 cents, 10 bucks, whatever it is. It helps us keep the lights on. Yeah, I think that's everything. Make sure that you tell your mom about the show, especially, other than your friends. The target this week is your mom. So until next time, we love you. Goodbye.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce. Let's hear more about that in the news with Daniel Tree.
Richard.
Let me try that again.
We'll cut that.